Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Jill Teigen. Teigen is an author, speaker, and electrical engineer. She is the CEO of Technically Speaking, a national consulting company specializing in improving opportunities for women and girls to have more career options in technology. She has published several books, including her most recent called Her Story, A Timeline of Women Who Changed America, co-authored by Charlotte Waisman and published by Collins. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, Tish.
Now, you've spent a good deal of your career bringing to light, promoting, and encouraging the careers of women, especially in engineering and science. How did you get involved in these issues?
In 1976, when I graduated from college, I went to the University of Virginia, and it was the third year that the University of Virginia had admitted women.
Wow.
So there were very few women at the university as a whole, and even fewer in engineering. But I didn't realize that there weren't very many women in engineering until I got out of college. But also, I had not been encouraged to be an engineer. I started in the School of Arts and Sciences. I had to transfer and be an engineer. And it just really was important to me that people who had, women particularly, who had the same skills and abilities that I had, were actually encouraged to be engineers. And then in 1979, I found the Society of Women Engineers. And that organization is dedicated to getting more women into science and technology and engineering and math careers.
Uh-huh.
Spent a lot of my volunteer time working with them.
Uh-huh. So if you weren't encouraged to be an engineer, what prompted you to get interested in it?
Well, I had taken math through calculus, and I had very, very strong math skills. And my first semester in college, it was just apparent to me, based on the friends that I had and the work that they were doing, that I was not in the right curriculum for me.
Hmm.
So I went and transferred into engineering.
Uh-huh. And it seems, isn't it amazing that during, you know, decades after the second wave of the feminist movement, that we're still talking about these issues? How is it now for women in engineering?
It's better than, the percentage of women is better. 1% of all engineering graduates in 1972 receiving a bachelor's degree were women. 1% in 72. It increased to 15.5% in 1985, and today it's still slightly under 20%. So we've not solved this problem.
Mm-hmm. And what do you attribute that to? Are there little codes or, you know, unsaid little, you know, things happening behind the backs of women that are discouraging them from getting involved in these issues and careers?
I've written a number of articles on this topic, and for a long time I believed that it was that women didn't understand the value that technology careers brought, and that by bringing forth the value, the fact that you and I are able to do a radio interview is made possible by technology,
mm-hmm.
that we have cell phones, that we have computers. Engineers do all the infrastructure, the roads, the bridges, the airports. And so I thought that was it for a while, but now I'm actually convinced that that's part of it, the value equation, the lack of knowledge about technology in our society, the fact that a lot of technology went underground after all of the environmental movements started bubbling up in the 1970s, because that fault was all technology, or that was the perception. And then I believe that there are still very strong underlying societal messages that women don't do those kinds of careers.
And then the importance of it, of course, is what you just said. It has to do with the whole infrastructure of our modern world, some of these professions, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Roads and bridges, their telecommunications infrastructure. I work in the electric utility industry. Electricity makes communications possible. It makes radio and television. It makes everything in our house work. We now have embedded chips in our stoves and in our microwaves. They don't work without electricity.
Mm-hmm.
They don't work without power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it behooves women to know what's happening in their world.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay, let's talk about her story now, A Timeline of Women Who Changed America. This began as a traveling timeline exhibit, right?
Well, that was Charlotte's exposure to the concept. Charlotte was teaching a leadership class for women, corporate women, about 40-ish years old, and she was talking about the women on whose shoulders we stand and those who came before us and how they paved the way for us to have the ability to do the things and have the lifestyle that we have today. And she said that those young women's eyes would just glaze over because they didn't know any of the women who came before us. So she started a little timeline, which was just pieces of 8.5 by 11 paper, scotch taped together, that she had developed, or her husband actually had developed, using an Excel spreadsheet. Uh-huh. And that's, she had about 300 women on that, her paper timeline when I met her.
Oh.
My interest actually started in 1987 when my colleague, whose name is Alexis, came back from the Society of Women Engineers National Convention with this idea for an outreach program to encourage more girls. That was a great Women in Engineering and Science essay contest.
Oh.
And I said, Alexis, that's just a wonderful idea. Who are they? Because like most people in the U.S., I knew one historical woman in engineering and science.
Indeed.
And that's Marie Curie, which is the common answer that I get when I ask audiences. And so we started doing all of this research because if you're going to have an essay contest for sixth graders, which was the age that we decided upon, and you're going to give prizes, you better make sure that those students are doing factual information.
Mm.
Because you don't want to give a prize to somebody who makes it all up and some of them did. And so that started my interest. And then when I was elected to the Society of Women Engineers National Board, the current president held up the nomination forms for the National Medal of Science and the National Medal of Technology, which people are not familiar with at all. Those are the U.S. equivalent of the Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
She asked who was going to do the nominations, and when no one raised her hand, I did.
Ah.
And I successfully nominated Admiral Grace Murray Hopper, who received the National Medal of Technology in 1991. And that, so this research for the essay contest and then successful nominations, I then nominated her successfully to the National Women's Hall of Fame, and that just started all of my interest in the historical women.
Uh-huh. So you decided to expand it out, obviously, beyond just women in technology and engineering.
Yes.
And how did you do your research for this, though?
For the book?
For the book, yeah.
We researched every source that we could find. Charlotte and I probably together have over 200 books. Then people would know that we were researching this topic and they would suggest other women to us. Because the problem is finding the women.
And I would think so.
They are. So many of women in U.S. history are invisible or forgotten. And that's one of the things we're trying to do with the book, to get the women out of the shadows and into their place in history, woven into the fabric of U.S. history by what we're doing.
Were you able to utilize the Library of Congress?
We used a lot of images from the Library of Congress for this book. We have over 130 images from the Library of Congress. There are over 1,000 images in the book. And so, yes, we used their resources. There are many libraries that have collections. People have donated their papers when they died, and there are pictures and information on the women on those sites. We used every source that we could find. And eventually, we were able to find a lot of information on the Internet, but we started with about 200 books.
And was there a way that you were able to make sure that your information was correct, and like what you said in regard to the essay contest?
Well, we vetted the information a lot. We tried to use sources that we thought were reputable. When there was a conflict of information between sources, then we sought additional sources, additional reference material, going back as far as we could to get as close as we could to primary material.
Mm-hmm. So women's history is still out there, but it's still buried.
It's very interesting. Charlotte and I did a presentation at the National Women's History Project in June in Minneapolis, and there was information presented on a woman whose name is Sarah Bard Field. I'm pretty sure that's her name. And there's just now primary research being done on her. She actually took a car in the 19-teens from Sacramento or San Francisco all the way to Washington, D.C. It took her something like 88 days. There weren't interstate highways.
Mm-hmm,
there wasn't information, and she was gathering petitions for a suffrage amendment. And that information is just now coming into the public light. So, yes, there is still primary research that's being done and information on women who are still lost. And then there are many women who are known regionally or in a city or in a county.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're in a particular profession, you know about the women pioneers in that profession. But other people don't know about those women. So when I go around and talk to people, I am still gathering names for the second edition. We have over 200 women.
Yeah.
Names that people have given to us.
Yeah, I'm going to bring that up toward the end of the interview for sure. That second edition fascinates me. Now how did you get Madeleine Albright to write the foreword for you? How did she get interested in this?
Madeleine Albright actually grew up in Denver, and she went to school with one of Charlotte's business partners. And Charlotte's business partner, Steffi Allen, who's actually in the book as well, said, I really think I should talk to Madeleine Albright about this. This is a topic that is near and dear to her heart. She's actually said, there's a quote that you can find on the web and in newspapers, there's a special place in hell for women who do not help other women. And so,
That's good.
So she really believes very strongly in getting women out of the shadows, and she agreed to write the foreword.
Uh-huh. And so tell us how you organized this book. I mean, you obviously had to stop at a certain number. Wouldn't you have 900 women in there approximately?
We have actually 866 women,
okay.
And then there are also historical events
mm-hmm.
that are throughout
with it.
The
yep.
book to give a historical context and a social context. And actually, we didn't cut out the number of women. We stopped when we had a publisher, the Collins imprint of HarperCollins. We had an editor basically said, we're going to move forward with what we are, with what we have. We actually added two women very close to the end of when the book was getting ready to move into its final stages. Once the layout was pretty well developed, because of the fact that it's a timeline format and it's so beautiful the way Laura Kostra, our graphic designer, laid it out. There did come a time when we had to stop. We go through 2007, though, and have women mm-hmm. from 1587 through 2007.
And I must say that the women from way back in history fascinate me more. We shall have to wait and see what some of these 21st century women do in some ways.
Well, actually, it's very interesting, and Charlotte and I have had that discussion because, for example, Danica Patrick is not in the book. Now, at the time of our cutoff, which was in mid-2007, she hadn't made the accomplishment in 2008 where she'd
won a
significant race. And so it was exactly that issue. Some of the women hadn't, quote-unquote, the more recent women hadn't proven themselves yet, and so they're not in the book. But mm-hmm. we're collecting those names.
Yeah, this is fascinating. It's fascinating to see this all in one book. I'm fascinated by history, too, and I'm wishing that more of the culture were interested in history. But let's talk about one of the women in the book. She was a precursor to Oprah Winfrey, Madam C.J. Walker. Tell us about her.
Madam C.J. Walker is in the book in 1905. She's actually cited by the Guinness World Book of Records as the first female American self-made millionaire, and she did that on cosmetics and hair care products, primarily for African American women.
And she was the daughter of slaves.
She was the daughter of slaves. And she brought herself up by her bootstraps. But when she developed her business, she also was determined that she was going to help others so they didn't have to work as hard. And I'm sure they worked hard, but they didn't. They actually were able. Her model was very much like the Mary Kay Ash model later in the 1960s, where her business model was actually to provide women who would otherwise be in domestic work or childcare work, an opportunity for economic self-sufficiency through her business by selling her hair care and products and cosmetics. Mm-hmm. An amazing woman.
Yeah, and I would guess that most people have never heard of her. I hadn't.
Many people.
How did she get lost in the fog, I wonder?
There's actually a stamp. She's on a postage stamp. If you grew up in Indiana or Indianapolis, there's a Madam C.J. Walker Museum, and I think there's a house there. I mean, there's a lot of focus, because I met someone recently from Indiana who said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I know who Madam C.J. Walker is. So that's what I'm saying. It really depends on where you grew up. I grew up in Virginia. I mean, we studied Pocahontas over and over and over. We knew who Martha Washington was. We knew who Dolly Madison was. We knew, all the presidents.
Most of the country does as well, yeah.
Right. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But, so it really, there are women who are known only in specific areas.
Uh-huh. And now that's going to change with
your
book.
I hope so.
To tell us about some of the other women that you discovered, are there any particular favorites?
Well, I'll tell you Charlotte's favorites first, and then I'll do mine.
Okay.
Since she's not here. Charlotte's favorites are the suffragists. She is just overwhelmed by the fact that it took 72 years to win the right to vote, and that only one of the women who signed the Declaration of Sentiments in 1848 was still even alive, although she wasn't able to vote. She was elderly. In 1920, when women won the right to vote, the fact that that was so selfless and so thoughtful of other people in all those efforts And then my woman is Admiral Grace Murray Hopper, the National Medal of Technology, the National Women's Hall of Fame, being at the launching of the destroyer Hopper at the Bath Iron Works in Maine when it was launched. She really was the catalyst that got me started and moving forward.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jill Teigen. She's the co-author of Her Story, A Timeline of the Women Who Changed America. And any other people that you particularly stand out in your mind?
One of them is very interesting. Charlotte and I discovered her, and I should say that we probably each had about 300 women that we knew about when we met, and there were many overlaps between the women that we knew, but we probably each individually discovered over 500 women during the course of putting this book together, and that's of the ones that were selected. We also discovered many, many other women. We probably looked at between 3,000 and 4,000 women in putting the book together and figuring out which ones were going to go in. And one of them, Eliza Lucas Pinckney, in 1744, at the age of 14, discovered a way to cultivate in large scale the plant indigo that actually then sustained the economies of the Carolinas for the next 30 years.
Wow.
And then she married well. She had two sons. One was a governor. One signed the Constitution. I mean, it's that strong women have strong children.
Uh-huh.
Just very fascinating, that whole process.
Yeah. And you know, I was fascinated by the woman called Lilla Cabot Perry, one of the first American Impressionist painters, and she was influenced by Claude Monet. I'd never heard of her. I don't think I've ever seen any of her paintings.
I had never heard of her. One of the things that
this
I have...
This is in 1889.
It's amazing. Charlotte is a speech and communications and fine arts. That is her degrees and her strengths. And then I'm an electrical engineer, so we have very complementary knowledge. And it was so interesting to us, because in the example of Lilla Cabot Perry, which I'm not sure was one of the ones that Charlotte knew, but one of the women that Charlotte knew was Isadora Duncan.
Ah, yes.
And we were going through one of these many, many books, and Charlotte said, "Well, of course, we're putting in Isadora Duncan." And I said, "Who is Isadora Duncan?" And she's just
really?
Looking at me because...
The mother of dance.
Yeah, how would I not know that? And then another time, we found Gertrude Elion in one of the publications we were going through. And I said, "Charlotte, we have to put Gertrude Elion in our book." And Charlotte is looking at me and saying, "Well, I've never heard of Gertrude Elion." Gertrude Elion won the Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine in 1988 for developing the first successful childhood leukemia drug.
Wow.
An amazing woman. I actually met her when I was at the White House receiving the National Medal of Technology for Admiral Hopper, because that day she was receiving the National Medal of Science. An amazing woman who fought incredible odds. She never got her PhD because during World War II, she was Jewish and they wouldn't accept her. And she spent her whole career developing drugs because her grandfather had died a very painful death from cancer. And she was just determined that she was going to help other people. An amazing woman. So, I mean, the experiences that we had in finding these women and selecting the women and then bringing them to life is so rewarding.
And it probably enriched your lives as well.
Absolutely.
A great deal.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk, before we run out of time, about your organization called Technically Speaking.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
My business is actually a combination of all of my vocations and avocations in life. I've been working on a volunteer basis and even on a professional level, and now through my company, in getting more women into science, technology, engineering, and math careers. I also do all of my consulting business through Technically Speaking, as well as all of the speaking and all of the book events through that business. I just really believe so strongly that young women should be encouraged to go into technology careers if they have the interest, instead of being discouraged, which still unfortunately happens today in 2008.
So does your organization actually prompt that interest? It seems to me there has to be something prodding children, young girls, to become interested in these subjects.
I help do outreach activities. I've been very involved with the Girl Scouts in doing science and math and technology events. I've worked with FIRST Robotics to do to encourage young women to understand the process of developing robots, which is very technology-oriented. So a lot still of outreach activities and visibility activities, giving engineering and science that visibility in the community.
Mm-hmm. And what about the schools? Don't you suppose it should start there?
I'm very hopeful that it would work in the schools. It's just a much harder nut to crack. The activities that I do through Girl Scouts, I also was the director of the Women in Engineering program at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where we did outreach activities through the middle schools, the high schools, and the elementary schools.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So did you find that, or do you surmise that schools are not really doing a good job of getting girls involved in these careers? Or is there just so much pressure on education to concentrate on testing, and, you know, so much is being lost, it seems.
I think there's a tremendous amount of pressure that's coming in education from almost every direction. And even the girls, my understanding is that the last time I looked at the statistics, that girls and boys are taking calculus, which is really one of the best indicators of who's going to pursue a technology career, in equal percentages in high school. But then there's this huge drop-off, even though there's adequate preparation, what we used to call the pipeline, for girls in those in the chemistry physics track and in the math track through calculus, but then there's a huge drop-off. And so I don't know if that's because they decide that through engineering they can't make a difference or if they're actively discouraged. I know that in Colorado the guidance counselors tell us that their main charge is to get the students graduated from high school. It's not to do what at one point would have been deemed to be career guidance, where they say, you know, with your skills and aptitudes, then you ought to think about medicine or law or engineering or accounting or whatever. But their primary focus is to get students to actually graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
Things are so much different in the schools than, of course, when I was coming through.
Oh, absolutely. Now, what are your hopes and dreams about this book?
This book, we believe, will be a nationwide bestseller. Though, when it is shown, we have a traveling display now that goes with it. When we show the display, when we speak, we sell all the books that anyone has brought. The event that I did this morning in Cortland, all of the books sold out. We want there to be a nationwide documentary. Of course, we want to be on Oprah. But more than that, we want it to be a nationwide bestseller, because this is how we're going to recover the women in history, is for the whole population to know about these women and to be proud of their accomplishments. And the other thing that we think is incredibly important is for young girls to be able to look at this book and to find the role models in there who are women like me, whether they want to be a photographer or they want to be a Nobel laureate or they want to be a politician or they want to be a doctor or a scientist or an engineer or an astronaut or an architect, or anything, a radio personality, a television personality, an athlete. All of those kinds of women are in there. We actually have a professions index as well as an alphabetical index in the back of the book.
Now, in the 21st century, it seems to me that there's a lot of women going into entertainment. Are you going to be really particular in the second volume about how you deal with women in entertainment?
We think we were pretty particular in the first volume
as well. But now we're in the 21st century.
Right.
It seems like there are more.
There are more, but with one of our selection criteria was that women were the first, or they were very significant. And so what happens in the U.S. is that we have such a short history memory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, someone told me, well, the first kindergarten was in St. Louis in 1960. Well, no, the first kindergarten was in Boston in 1860. And so many of the women who are in entertainment in the 21st century are not going to be first, because Halle Bailey already won an Oscar and Hattie McDaniel already won an Oscar,
right.
And women have already directed movies and women have already produced significant, you know, amounts of TV and radio. And so what Charlotte and I like to say about the women who are selected for the book, because people will argue, well, why is this person in and why isn't this woman in? And we say in the end, it's our book. It's idiosyncratic. We recognize that it is. Every other book that we looked at is also idiosyncratic. Mm-hmm. We had selection criteria.
This history is.
And when we needed to break our rules, we broke our rules. An example is Katharine Graham.
Mm.
We said women had to make it on their own, without their father's money and without their husband's money and without their brother's money. Well, her father built the Washington Post. When he was ready to retire, he gave it to her husband. And then when he died, she took over the operation. But it was her decision to publish the Pentagon Papers and to break the Watergate story, so she had to be in the book.
Oh, she was absolutely a significant
person
in history.
Very significant.
Yeah.
And so we recognize that it's idiosyncratic, but there are many women in the entertainment field who are in the book, and there are many women in the entertainment field who are not in the book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's talk about the second edition that you will be working on or are now. To tell us about that. And I understand people can nominate women
for this. Oh, yes. On our website, www.herstoryatimeline.com, there is actually a place where you can fill out and nominate a woman. There's lots of other things on our website as well, information about our speaking opportunities and such. We're finding as we go around, I mean, when people told us about women, we hadn't heard of them, and now there's still, there was one this morning that I learned about, I'd never heard of her, at my speaking engagement. So we write them all down, we've put them in a spreadsheet, we have over 200 women already, and if we have the opportunity to do another edition or a book, then we're willing to consider all of those women.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're fascinating women, and they've been in the shadows, and we need to bring them out of the shadows.
So is this a new tack that you're taking for the second edition? You're letting people nominate? In the first one, this was all research just done by you and Charlotte? Or were you nominating?
People nominated in the first edition as well. There are very specific examples of women who are in the first edition that we would have never come across or had not come across or heard of that are in the book because someone nominated them.
Uh-huh. And can you tell us a few of the ones that are coming up in the second edition that we might not have heard of?
Interestingly, the one I learned about this morning, her name is Ada Blackjack. She was an Alaska Inuit, and she was on one of the early polar expeditions. She was the only woman on one of the polar expeditions, and she was the only survivor.
Wow.
Of the expedition. And so I haven't done any research on her. I mean, what I've done so far is people are suggesting women to us. I mentioned Danica Patrick. Danica Patrick is now on the list of women to consider for the second edition. And there are just, I don't remember all of them, but there are many women from all walks of life. I mean, we have, that's one of the things we're incredibly proud of in the book, is the inclusiveness of the women in the book. It's, yes, it's all ethnicities, but it's also every field of endeavor, adventurers, mm-hmm.
And the criterion is they have to be Americans. Is that
they
correct?
They have to at least have become naturalized.
Mm-hmm.
We do have many women in the book who were born elsewhere. Madeleine Albright was born elsewhere.
Yep.
Catherine Stern was born elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Many were born elsewhere but became naturalized citizens.
Mm-hmm. And Jill, tell us the website again where people can nominate and find more information. This is a great book. Go out and buy it. I'm serious. It's fascinating.
www.herstoryatimeline.com.
And that's where you get all the information, and you can nominate somebody for Volume 2. Well, when do you suppose that'll come out?
I don't know. This book came out April 1st. We're very
focused
on the marketing and promotion of the book. We think it's beautiful. We think it's a very significant addition to the literature. And I will tell you that when other people see it, they just really are taken with it and buy multiple copies. I mean, we've had people, the most I know that someone has bought so far is 27 copies.
That's amazing.
But it's a gorgeous
book. Yep.
They give it as a gift to all their family members, all their friends. Mm-hmm. We have a couple who've bought 22 copies. Many women this morning bought 3 or 4 or 5 copies.
That's great. It's a great addition to the history in this country, especially about women. Jill Teigen, thank you so much for joining us. I wish you well with this. Her Story, A Timeline of the Women Who Changed America. Go out and buy it. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.